CliffCentral.com.
So, lots of exciting things happening today. We'll find out a little later on how easy it is to go and live and work in the United States and what you would need to do to be able to do that. There are lots of options for South Africans who want to chase the American dream. And later on today, we'll have American Dream, who are specialists in EB-5 investments, to tell us about some of the options that you could explore and consider if you want to move there. You know, it's a bit of information for those people who want to go. Best that you arm yourself with the most info you can get and the best info you can get.
And prepare yourself for a lot of paperwork.
That's right. There's a lot of paperwork, but we'll find out exactly what's required there as well. So hopefully we'll make it easier for you if you want to do that. Lots of stuff going on in the news. Plenty of stories that may or may not have caught your attention. But Leanne found something interesting about fertility rates. There are a lot of people who are trying to have kids, and there are a lot of people who don't want kids in the world. But apparently, they've been doing some research and they found out some very interesting statistics about human fertility at the moment and what's going on in that department.
Well, I had to remind myself what fertility rate means in terms of demographics, revisiting my days of geography in high school. Because mm-hmm. Immediately I thought, do they mean women who are fertile?
Yes, not barren.
Yes. So it's not that. It's
like Abraham's wife, Sarah, who was barren.
Oh. It's the number of children that women are having. So keeping right. that in mind, I was able to dissect the story
and
a bit better.
And that's because men can't have children on their own.
Yes, they can try, but it's not going to work.
No, I don't think it will.
So now they're really surprised by these results, the researchers, because it's found that nearly half of the countries in the whole world are facing a baby bust, meaning that there are insufficient children to maintain their population size.
No, but that's good, right?
That's what I thought.
This is where Thanos puts on the glove with the Infinity Stones and half the people are gone.
And that's what I thought, but there are obviously profound consequences for societies who aren't expecting this. Japan knows mm-hmm. that it's happening. They have various systems in place for
the
this.
The Scandinavians have a similar problem.
Yeah. But a lot of societies just aren't prepared for the fact that there are going to be more grandparents than grandchildren in the world or in their country.
Mm. So I would imagine, again, it's places like Japan, it's places like Norway and Sweden. And
You'd be quite surprised by that as well. I'll get to that now. But just to compare, in 1950, women were having an average of 4.7 children in their lifetime.
Wow.
That's a lot, yeah.
Now?
And it's now all but halved to 2.4 children per woman.
Well, we're getting closer and closer to that golden two. If it's two children, one to replace each parent, that is environmentally sustainable.
So let's look at the highest fertility rate versus the country with the lowest. Fertility in Niger is 7.1.
Okay, that's quite a lot.
That's an average of seven children.
Maybe Niger can show the rest of us how to do it better.
And then in Cyprus, women are having one child on average, and that one's the lowest. The UK, to give you a roundabout idea, is around 1.7, mm-hmm. similar to most Western European countries.
Right.
So when...
Are you nervous? I pick up in your voice that you're...
I feel responsible for a lot of this because I haven't had a child.
You haven't got any children.
Right.
I'm with the I Never Want Babies clan.
Okay.
I'm not having children because I'd rather save the planet.
All right. Well, nice of you. You're saving the planet for other people's children.
Yeah, exactly.
You thought about how ironic that is.
Yeah, I'm now thinking that.
Go on.
So where everyone's asking why this is happening.
Yeah. Tell us.
So it's not down to sperm counts or anything that normally comes to mind with this sort of thing when you think of fertility. It's been put down to three factors. Fewer deaths in childhood, meaning mm-hmm. women have fewer babies. Mm-hmm. Greater access to contraception, more women in education and work. And then
those are all good things.
Yeah.
This should be how a prosperous society shows itself. By women, first of all, having the ability to choose whether or not they want to get pregnant. Mm. And second of all, having less of those uglinesses associated with what used to be a very dangerous thing, childbearing. It used to be very, very hard for women to be assured that they wouldn't die in childbirth, let alone the child itself.
So what will the impact be? And we're thinking it can only be good. But without migration, countries will face aging and shrinking populations. Dr. George Leeson, who's the director of the Oxford Institute of Population Aging, mm-hmm. says the whole of society is just not ready for it. If you think about it, demography impacts on every single aspect of our lives. So he says, for instance, workplaces are going to have to change, and even the idea of retiring at 68 has to change.
But don't you think that's it's about time? Like, why people shouldn't have to retire? You think about how brilliant someone who's got like 60 years of experience in a particular field is. There's something about that person, and I'm not saying that they need to hang around forever, but it is really, really helpful to have people who have institutional knowledge, institutional memory, people who've been around, watched the changes occur, have some kind of resistance to change built into them, just like you want the people who are accepting of change, the young people who've got new ideas. You want some of that old.
I think if it's your choice to stay in the workplace and impart wisdom, great. But if it's a problem, and the fact that there's no one else to take your place, and you have... Imagine Ben having to stick around.
I mean, he's not going to last another 5 years.
I'm coming back strong, motherfuckers. I told you.
Yeah.
Rock bottom. I'm going to become one of those motivational people. You have to now do incredible things in order to stand up.
And you will be able to impart a wisdom on how you were able to put your socks on in 8 seconds.
Yeah. And make a video with...
All right, but there's another problem here, and that is that... In these countries where they have a negative birth rate, where fertility is dropping, the population very often are dependent on young people because they're the ones who work the hardest and the longest and who have the most applicability, I suppose, in the job market. You need to have a young population in order to keep the old population alive because the state doesn't make its welfare treasury operate well on old people. That's an expense. Young people bring in the money. Old people spend it.
Yeah. That's
so you need to have young people. And in many of these countries where they do have social welfare, places again like Scandinavia, your young population is now smaller than your old population, which means no one's paying. Someone, the money has to come from somewhere.
And just to let you know, Scandinavia didn't even make it onto the bottom 10 countries.
Really?
Yeah. So they are Japan... Then Moldova. Remember, Cyprus is the lowest.
It's the lowest, yeah.
So we're going from number 10 downwards. Japan, Moldova, Poland, Bosnia, Thailand, Puerto Rico, Andorra. In third place, South Korea. Second place, Taiwan. And then Cyprus.
It's interesting, some of these holiday locations.
Yeah.
You would think.
Thailand, I'm surprised by that.
Definitely. And then on the other end of the scale, the top 10 countries with the most fertility.
These are countries where there's no problem with fertility.
No problem at all.
People are just farting out children left, right, and center. All right, let's go. What are they?
9 of them are African countries.
Ah.
Good old us.
The one that isn't is Afghanistan.
Oh.
They're the only one who's joining us in the multiple child household.
Afghanistan. I mean, who would want to have children in a place like that?
So in 10th place, it's Angola, then Uganda, Burundi, Burkina Faso, South Sudan, Afghanistan. In fourth place, Mali, and then Somalia, Chad, and Niger, as mentioned.
All right. Carl's just written to me now. Carl DeSantos, he says, are you telling me that if I identify as a woman, I can't have a child on my own as a man?
Carl,
yeah, all right.
Okay, you
well,
got us.
It's interesting because according to a few reports, Italy is also bearing this in mind, this whole fertility rate. And they are now, as a country, offering land as incentive to couples to have 3 children or more. So this whole new thing is now saying to parents, if you produce 3 children by 2021, you must get on it then if you want to qualify for this.
Right.
Then you can get some land in Italy. This is an offer which is limited, however, to married Italian couples. And
because you can't have children in sin.
Oh, no, out of wedlock. And foreign couples who have lived in Italy for at least 10 years are also eligible. So,
Okay, well, good for the Italians. They'll attract a whole lot of the very fertile people from Niger.
But once again, you think this great romantic destination. I'd have children
if they gave me land. I'd have children.
Would you?
But I'd need land.
Three kids? Oh, you know, I'd get the three kids and then they'll work on the land. And correct. Then, yeah, it balances out. Oh, guys, let's get working.
Right, so Michelle says, hey, Ben, I'm sorry about your back, but stop with all this talk about old people. I'm 45. Michelle.
I didn't bring up the old people. It was more Gareth.
45, you're still in your juicy years. You're a ripe mango.
Anushka says, shame, guys. I think you were not sexually harassed at the SABC because you weren't sexual harassment material. No one was attracted
enough.
So I
was the only one then.
Yes. Yes, you see? A lot of people are worried about being harassed, but they're too ugly. You've got to remember, some of us are too ugly to be sexually harassed.
God, what a thought.
Guillermo says, sometimes I want to slap my staff on the ass. I really do, but I can't. Yes, Guillermo, you can't.
Is it maybe a bad thing having those thoughts?
Well, you can have the thoughts. There's no crime in thinking those things, but you certainly can't act on them. All right? Don't you dare. And then a few other things that have come up in the last couple of days, and a lot of people are talking, obviously, about what's in the news with politics and Armistice Day and Trump not pitching up for that that commemoration ceremony. But China's largest ride-sharing app. Now, you know, we've got Uber. We use Uber a lot here in South Africa.
Yeah.
Theirs is called Didi.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they've been making some terrible mistakes. There are 550 million people registered with Didi. What's the problem now?
The problem is, it's actually quite horrific to think about.
Okay.
In August this year, a 20-year-old woman in China went missing on her way to a birthday party while riding Didi. She had called Didi's ride-sharing service, Didi Hitch, to get a ride from, from one place to the other. Along the way, the driver diverted from the obvious route, turning off onto steep mountain roads.
Uh-oh.
This girl, Xia Zhao, then messaged a friend saying that she thought something was wrong. At around 2 in the afternoon, she sent two more messages to her friend. They simply said, help and save me.
Oh, my God.
Her friend immediately contacted Didi, but was put on hold. The girl's parents called the police. In the early hours of the next morning, police officers arrested a 27-year-old man who led them to Zhao's body. He had raped and killed her and then threw her body off a cliff.
Good Lord. Okay, let's just be fair, though. 550 million people use Didi.
Yes, but
one nutcase abducts a girl.
This is the second time and a separate driver.
So, as I said, two nutcases have done this, and now suddenly Didi's a problem.
Well, I mean, due to social media, the hashtag woman killed in Didi Hitch was trending. It was seen more than 430 million times on Chinese social media services.
Hmm.
So Chinese celebrities posted photos of themselves while they were deleting the app. So it's been a really, really big thing.
Hmm.
It's obviously a huge thing for them because just last year, they were rated at, I'm just trying to find, $56 billion. That's how big the company is. And something like this, for instance, when this murder occurred, the head of Hitch and another top executive were fired. They also suspended all late-night ride-hailing services for a week, and that cost them $128 million in revenue. So even though it's one or two drivers, it's having
three.
A huge effect.
That's terrible. You don't think about it, because someone was jokingly saying to me the other day that you used to tell kids not so long ago, do not get into a stranger's car.
Yeah.
Remember that was the rule?
Mm.
When I was at school, you didn't get into a stranger's car. You didn't talk to stranger. Stranger danger. Now, you get them on the app. You're like, hey.
Hey, stranger.
I'll hop in your car, stranger. I'll even pay you.
There were even reports of people hanging around at airports. I think it was Cape Town International at the time, who looked for these drivers in cars who were not Uber drivers.
Yeah.
They kind of scan for somebody using their phone and looking up to find
the
car. Yeah, and you get in and you don't check that they're your guy.
I always check the registration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
and I've been
look out.
I've been proud of Uber, this is really not buying face, but this is what I've dealt with recently with their drivers. They will also, on their part, ask me what my name is, yes, to confirm. So I guess even drivers at this point are also feeling like they need to tighten up security. So it's a good part. Mm. It's a good thing on their part.
All right. Where does, before we get to how to go to the US, you'll need a resume. You'll need, yes, a CV. Now, where does this come from, this idea of a resume, a CV? I have one in theory. I've never used it. I don't think I've ever sent anyone a resume. I should really update it. Everybody should.
Yeah, you're supposed
it's
to
something
update
you should,
it all
you
the
should
time.
Have on file, and you, yeah, should make adjustments to it every time you get a new certificate, qualification, a bit of job experience, you do a project you're very proud of. You should really have a huge document. It's essentially it's a summary of your life. It's kind of important. You need to know what's in there. This is what prospective employers would look at, right?
But isn't that like LinkedIn now? If you're not doing it on LinkedIn, it shows that you're not technologically savvy. And, yeah, if you're not updating LinkedIn, then you basically, who wants you?
So that's the whole thing now, is that could the resume be dying? So I really found this interesting. I don't usually find historical things interesting, but there's one man credited with crafting the very first resume,
mm-hmm,
and his name is Leonardo da Vinci.
Really?
It was apparently years before he began painting.
Hmm.
So that was in 1482, around the time he was 30 years old. He was looking to find a job, so he, as a military engineer.
Yes.
And he got the job and ended up painting from that job as well.
Wow. So that he did the first resume.
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad.
Well, yes, it's apparently in those days he would have used a professional writer. He wouldn't have written it himself.
Well, he was a professional at everything.
Yeah, exactly.
He was the original Renaissance man, so I'm sure he did some of the writing himself.
That's it.
He was a bloody genius. This guy. What did he put? CV, Leonardo da Vinci. Genius. What do you put there? Military engineer stroke genius. Stroke,
well,
world's most famous
artist.
This
is what he wrote. He had a 10-point list of his abilities that included bridge, cannon, catapult construction.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, it's the construction of those three things. I thought, yeah, he was,
no,
playing
he didn't
bridge.
Play bridge. Yeah, that's not going to help you in no, the Renaissance. Being able to play bridge isn't going to get you a job.
Water removal from moats. And then he had a small mention of his artistic skills at the end.
You know what? I've been looking for a water removal from moats expert for the longest time. If only I'd known Leonardo, yes, da Vinci was available.
You've got to be proud of your achievements. All of them.
Damn straight. And how many people you know who can remove water from a moat? Huh?
So if you fast forward a couple of centuries, the resume didn't have much success after he invented it.
For about 400 years, it just lay around.
Yeah, for about 50 years. So, mm-hmm, a guy named Daniel Howden.
Yes. Oh, Daniel. Yeah, we know him.
Mm-hmm.
What about him?
So, apparently, you had to insert your age, your weight, and your heritage, moving on from like the 1900s to 1950. Yeah, you had to put in your weight, etc. And then the lack of CV actually became quite popular because people should have known what, you know, in British circles, you say they know your place.
Oh, you mean your status, your position in the hierarchy?
All dictated by birth and status.
Sure.
And so that's why it wasn't really fashionable anymore to have a resume. But yeah, it continued to rear its little head. And between 1990 and 2010, we had the internet, and that changed everything.
Well, that's what Ben was saying. You need to be on LinkedIn now.
Correct. 87% of recruiters used LinkedIn to vet hiring candidates. So yeah, they think it's probably going to die very soon.
Oh no. It started off with emptying water from a moat.
Yes.
And now it's going to die as a document of any worth. Well, I still think it's a good idea to keep your CV and to keep it updated. I get one almost every other week from someone who's looking for a job, so people do. They look at them. I mean, whether or not it's just a background info thing or whether it's something you really regard as being important and integral.
It's quite hard to sit down and do. I think it's a mental struggle
as well.
You're
summarizing your whole life.
Your whole life, yeah. And you look at it and you think, is this who I am?
Oh, well,
it's always disappointing, right?
You just show off the good parts.
But isn't it always disappointing? How do you squeeze, like, let's say, 10, 20, 30 years into two pages? It's hard.
I'm just wired differently. Give me 2 minutes and I'll give you a whole PowerPoint presentation about how great I am.
Yes, that's right.
I'll give you a whole 3 meter long scroll.
I'm just scared someone expects too much of me then. I'd rather surprise during.
Oh, you're the under-deliver under-promise, over-deliver person. Oh, okay.
See, as the over-promise, under-deliver person. All right. Listen, speaking of over-promising and under-delivering, a lot of people are kind of a little disillusioned with what's going on in the world, and they want to be able to move around freely. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. In fact, I completely and wholeheartedly support it. I think that you are able to decide in the 21st century where you would like to put your productivity, where you'd like to be a useful and helpful citizen, and you might want to go to countries all over the world. The best options for South Africans who want to chase the American dream, and that's obviously the group's name here, the American dream, they're specialists in EB5 investments. They're going to tell us some of the options that we can explore and consider. So find out all about the team from American Dream. They've got a dedicated team of people of EB5 experts who are going to identify and structure EB5 products and projects that maximize the success of visa applications while providing capital to qualifying development projects. You need to know the rules. You need to know what's going on here in order to make maximal use of it. And that's what we thought we would do this morning, is help you figure it out, help you to be part of, you know, the informed series of or rather the informed group of South Africans who are making these moves with all the information that they can possibly get at hand. So we're going to speak to Leon Fashfeldt and to Stuart Ferguson. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us this morning. Yeah, nice to see you.
Thank you. Good
morning. And hopefully you can help us to navigate our way through this. Clearly this has become something that a lot of South Africans are interested in. A lot of South Africans are making moves. They're able to determine a place where their labor is most maximally used and where they can put themselves and their families in the best possible situation and position. And that's something which you can help people to do.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, moving to America seems to be something that for the last 100 years people have considered to be a move that's positive for your family, for your potential, your ability to earn, your ability to be part of a society that is moving forward. The American economy is booming at the moment.
Absolutely.
Lots of people want to be part of that, right?
Absolutely, Garrett. I mean, the surge of inquiries that we've had in the last year has just been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, I've been involved in the EB5 arena, specifically focusing.
What is EB5? Let's start with that.
Yeah, EB5 in a very simple form is it stands for Employment Based Program Number 5.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a federal underwritten program. Certain regional centers, which are legal entities, are authorized by immigration and also have various securities warranties.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fully regulated program.
So this is because countries like America want to attract the talent, and they want to create a space that is navigable for people who want to join the American economy, who want to be a part of that society, and they fast track the people most useful to them.
Correct.
Is that what it is?
It's an investment visa. So
right.
They're looking to lure sophisticated, high net worth individuals who are going to contribute towards the American economy and in an indirect way provide Americans with jobs.
So, Stuart, how did you get involved in this? Is it something you've been doing for some time?
I've been involved for the last in excess of 10 years. It was actually by default. We were a South African consortium who had been buying various properties for a long period of time in the U.S. And it was during the subprime crisis when we had some greenfields developments that we were looking to develop. And we were looking for a mechanism to unlock additional equity into those projects.
Mm-hmm.
And we, by default, came across the EB5 program and realized that we could lure South Africans who would co-invest with us at cost. And by virtue of us constructing and developing, they would be providing the required 10 jobs for Americans. And that's how we got into the EB5 arena. And we subsequently there evolved to having representation in Shanghai, Beijing, because obviously the Chinese are very prolific under the EB-5 program. Mm-hmm. We've now got office representation in the UAE and India. Hmm. India is a very large marketplace. And just recently started being very active in Vietnam. So the popularity of EB-5 is quite extensive.
I would imagine a lot of people are looking at America right now because, as we discussed, the economy seems to be growing. Unemployment is right down. They're looking for ways to find the very best people who are going to add value to that society. And if they come from South Africa or they come from India or they come from China or wherever else, they're only too happy to have them, especially if they're putting money in, right?
Absolutely.
So, Leon, how did you get involved in this?
So, I graduated from Takisovio, and from there...
Me too, I'm sorry for both.
Yeah. I practiced here for a little bit, and then I immigrated to the United States myself. So I navigated the immigration system and currently practicing law in the United States.
How hard was it for you to do?
So, I practiced law in the state of Missouri, which is right in the middle of the country, and... there was a requirement in most jurisdictions that require you to have graduated from an accredited American law school. I actually filed an ex parte petition with the Missouri Supreme Court asking them to waive that requirement and allow me just to go sit for the bar. It was a little bit challenging, but they ultimately ended up allowing me to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And then having their blessing to go write the bar, I wrote the bar and practiced law there for a little bit. I did a variety of litigation prior to getting into immigration, but, you know, like an old law professor in Pretoria said, the first day of law school, he asked, so what are you going to specialize in? And, you know, people would say, I'm going to specialize in bankruptcy. There was no way that I was going to think at that point in time, I'm going to specialize in immigration.
Immigration, sure.
But he made a very valid point. He said, you've got to specialize in what your clients are going to tell you to specialize in, because you can be the best bankruptcy lawyer, mm-hmm. but if you don't have clients, you know, you're not going to specialize in anything. Mm-hmm. My practice gravitated towards immigration to a great extent. Out of the middle of the country, where some of my colleagues asked me, how is it possible that you don't speak a lick of Spanish and you're in the middle of the country, and how is it possible that you can be successful? I mean, immigration is federally regulated, so we represent people from all over the country who wants to immigrate to the United States.
All right.
And so,
are a lot of South Africans coming to you guys at the moment?
They are. You know, when we first got started, my partner, his name is Etienne Hugo, he practices law, also graduated from Tukis and went to Australia.
Okay.
There was a bigger search for clients from South Africa going to Australia at the time when we got together, and not too much coming to the United States. Always kind of been a little bit of a challenging. The law hasn't changed.
No, but you know. Do you think that's because South Africans look at Australia and they say, well, both Southern Hemisphere countries, reasonably similar culture in some ways? I mean, America's got – I would find more in common, I think, with a Texan than I would with an Australian.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of people have come to find that to be the truth.
Yeah.
I think at the time, it was an easy transition from the Southern Hemisphere to go into the schools. I mean, we start our school halfway in the middle of the year.
Is that what it is? It's kids mostly that make the decisions, right?
Yeah.
Or make parents make the decisions they make.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So this EB-5 thing, what are the – give me the basics of what I need to fulfill in terms of requirements. If I wanted to go to America, how would I comply with the requirements of –
Quite simple, Gareth. There are only two requirements. One, you can't be a hardened criminal, and B, source of funds has got to come from a legitimate source, and that really is the only criteria.
That's it.
There's no age limit. There is no educational requirements. There are no the medicals are pretty non-invasive. They really just check for TB. So long as you are not a hardened criminal and have money that comes from legitimate sources.
How much do you need to use? How much do you need to find? How much do you need to pay over?
Your capital contribution into a project is $500,000 USD, and that typically gets locked away for 5 years.
Okay.
It gets locked away or invested in that project for 5 years because that is really the immigration timelines that you'll follow, and Leon will go into a bit of detail on that shortly.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously you've got additional admin fees which get paid to your facilitators, and then you've got legal fees. So you would engage with Leon as your legal representative, and he holds your hand through the process. So all in all, dependent on the project that you're investing into, it's between $560,000 and about $580,000.
Okay.
You know, when I visit with some of these investors, I say I don't want to oversimplify it, but it boils down to two basic questions. Can you get me a green card?
Mm-hmm.
And can I get my money back at the end of the day? This is, after all, an investment. And a lot of people
you're
meet
not,
with...
You're not giving you're not giving $500,000 to the U.S. government.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it is an investment.
And the green card, is that hard to get?
It is. I mean, you know, like Stuart was alluding to, this green card, the EB-5 process, is just one option. I mean, there's a variety of different other options in order to get permanent residency. The one popular one, obviously, being married to a U.S. citizen. But there's other ways to get it.
Yes, I know lots of South Africans who've thought about that. And no, yeah. Seriously. I have friends who've honestly thought that the best way for them to get into the U.S. is to marry some woman that they just met on the internet.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, we have represented quite a variety of extraordinary people from South Africa.
Sure.
Who have actually have got into the EB-1 category. Wherein
is that special skills?
It's not quite special skill. You need to show that you are extraordinary in your field. Like some boxers who've won some, you know, big championships over here.
Okay.
Some athletes who've played, you know, for the Springboks, you know, hockey.
Well, there we are, Leanne. That's your way in.
So, I mean, there's some other ways, you know, in order to obtain permanent residency other than that. But why this program is so popular is because every administration that comes around gives a little bit of a different spin to this administrative process.
Uh-huh.
In the Obama administration, I mean, you know, the EB-5 was also pretty strong, but with this new presidency that we have in place, he is one that obviously with a mindset of someone who does business, I like the idea of someone who's actually contributing to the United States in mm-hmm. a significant way. I have to prove that this investor who's going to invest $500,000 in the United States, I have to prove that 10 jobs for U.S. citizens are actually going to get created
yep.
as a result thereof.
Okay, hang on, because people would think almost the opposite was true. They hear about Trump talking about immigration the whole time. He's talking about illegal immigration.
Absolutely.
He doesn't like illegal immigration.
Absolutely.
He doesn't mind migrants. As long as you're documented, as long as you're legal, as long as you're going to do what you say you're going to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, the Trump family have been great supporters of EB-5 for a number of years. A lot of their developments, they've raised a fair amount of their
capex. Most Trump's wives have been migrants of some kind.
Absolutely, correct. But, yeah, I mean, Trump and his inner circle are very, very much pro EB-5. The EB-5 program in its current format is under a lot of pressure by virtue of its popularity.
Yeah.
So we are expecting some major overhauls of the program. And in fact, there's a draft bill that has already been presented before Congress. And we're expecting that should be ratified as part of his next sort of steps as he gets back into the immigration realm.
All right. So tell me how we go about this. Do we get hold of you guys directly? I mean, imagine there's someone listening now who has decided they want to build a future for themselves, maybe for their children, maybe for the extended family in America. They want to now get in contact with you and start the process. What's the best way of doing that?
See, it could be either way. I mean, sometimes people find the investment first, where they like the investment first, and then they find a lawyer in order to help them with the green card aspect thereof. Other times they have the lawyer first to help them go find particular investments that we give a couple of options to that they can go.
And you can do either way.
Either way, yeah.
Okay. So again, what's the best way to get hold of you?
Yeah, I mean, Garrett, the easiest way would be for them to give myself or one of my colleagues a direct phone call or log on to our website.
What's your website?
It's www.americandream-eb5.com. We do a very quick sort of due diligence on an inward bound inquiry just to make sure that they meet the basic minimum eligibility test.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously we have a number of projects that we currently are busy promoting. So a number of our projects in the Florida region are sort of closing up. We're almost fully subscribed.
Mm-hmm.
We've got one which is very close to Leon City, Kansas City, which is a refurbishment of an old historic building into a hotel. And then we've got some nice, exciting projects coming out shortly, which will be based in Chicago. But they would make a simple application. We'd call them up. And then share some information related
to the
project.
And then they'd
look
at the investment and they'd go, yeah, this is something I'm interested in, or no, I'm not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's critical that we get them to actually really understand the investment.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, EB-5 is really just the marketing tool to engage with a high net worth individual. We align ourselves to them for a period of 5 years. So during those 5 years, we tend to get to know the family unit exceptionally well, exactly what their aspirations are, and we hope to develop that relationship where they actually become seasoned investors of ours.
Right.
How long does the whole process take from application? So, I mean, you know, what if somebody is looking at it, but only in a year or two's time? Should they start the process now?
Absolutely. I think it's worth evaluating, especially in light of some changes that are currently pending before Congress. I mean, they are talking about a significant increase in the minimum investment, going from 500 to some talks over 950, some talks to over $1 million. So it's definitely worth engaging to talk about those timeframes, because those timeframes can be manipulated in many ways. So we have some doctors who said, hey, look, you know, I'm planning this more for my kid than I want to do it for me, but eventually, when I retire, I may want to go over there too. So there's some ways to manipulate it. But to answer your question, the adjudication times right now, based from USCIS, which is the government agency that oversees all of this, is about 18 to 24 months. Some cases we've seen go a little bit faster, but that's kind of the time frame that you can expect. Once the case is approved by immigration in the United States, then we process the application here at the consulate. That could add another 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
Once the consulate is happy with what's going on, they will give you an immigrant sticker that's good for 6 months. And within that 6 months, you just go make a trip to the United States. Unlike Australia, where you need to pack up and leave and sell everything you have to do in immediately. I mean, you can make a trip into the United States, go activate your green card. Typically, we have those green cards shipped to our office. And then from there, we'll find out where you're at, and we'll ship the green card to wherever you're at. So we can manipulate those time frames. The only thing where it sometimes gets a little bit challenging with some of the high net worth investors that we represent is a guy who just sold his company. He's got a commitment to stick around for 5 years. Immigration says that if you're going to be out of the country for at least more than a year with a green card, we may have an assumption that you probably don't want to be a permanent resident anymore. Well, we can rebut that presumption by filing some additional paperwork with immigration that says, hey, look, this guy's not going to be here for another 2 years. And so we're letting you know ahead of time so that there's no sense of an assumption that he's abandoning his permanent residency.
Right. Those are obviously just fallbacks for them so that they can figure out whether or not people actually want to be a part of the system.
Yeah.
And some folks keep it as a fallback, just as a, hey, I can leave tomorrow, I can leave next year, I can leave 3 years from now.
Uh-huh.
But the timeline just from there is they give you a conditional green card, which is good for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Before that 2 years expire, then we'll go back to the regional center. Mm-hmm. We'll go show immigration that the investment is still at risk, which is a major component.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that the jobs were created. Immigration then lifts that condition and give you a 10-year green card. And 5 years from the day you got that 2-year green card, when you're counted on, you'll be eligible for U.S. citizenship should you want to do so.
The South 5 years on. Huh?
5 years. There is the eligibility criteria looking back after that 5 years is whether or not you've been in the United States accumulatively for 2.5 years to see if you're eligible. But other than that, the South African government, at least for right now, allows you to become a dual citizen if you file certain paperwork with them before you become a naturalized citizen.
So it sounds like you can have your cake and eat it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, this is fantastic. So I'm sure that there'll be plenty of people who'd be interested in knowing more. You can head onto their website and you can go and find out more. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming to spend some time with us today. The website is americandream-eb5.com. And you can find out all the information there. Decide whether you want to first make an investment that you've seen, that you've had your eye on, and then figure out the legal qualifications afterwards, or whether or not you'd like to see the lawyer first and then decide on an investment.
And our website is www.versfeldlaw.com, like Loftus Versfeld.
VersFeldLaw.com if you want to find out more there. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This is terrific. So the best immigration options to the U.S., EB-5, hopefully we've answered some of those questions, residency programs, EB-5 projects offered by the American Dream, and where in America you can start. I mean, all of these things can be answered. You can go along to the website. You can email the guys if you need to know more to find out how you can make your move. There we go.
Excellent.
Very helpful.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to speak to Rich Mulholland in a moment and find out from him how his trip to Brazil went, what he got up to, because he spent a couple of days in Brazil.
Maybe he got a Brazilian wax.
Is that why you would go?
Yeah. Go straight to the professionals.
You know you can get those here.
Oh. Who knew?
Oh. All right. That was fantastic. It's interesting to find out how it's not actually that hard.
It's not that hard, but it's still kind of scary. Whew. If I try and put myself in that position, that mindset of changing my life completely.
Are we talking
scary.
About the Brazilian wax still, or are we talking about American immigration?
Yeah, still the Brazilian wax.
Sorry, you said it's not that hard. $500,000, not that hard?
No, well, for someone who's worked most of their life and has hopefully saved something, then
$500,000?
You know, that's a lot of money. Sure, it's a lot of money.
I'm going to put that in the hard category, Gareth.
Okay. All right, Ben. They're not going to just let you in. I mean, unless you join that migrant caravan, they're not going to just take you in. All right, is Rich there? Nolo? We got Rich. Oh, what does that mean? She's busy gesticulating wildly. Does that mean he's there or he isn't? Give me the thumbs up if he is, thumbs down if he isn't. Thumbs down. Okay, well, this is complicated. It's like that category in Facebook for relationships. It's complicated.
It's complicated.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Let me just see what else I've got here while we're waiting for Rich. Oh, we've got to the Australian High Commissioner on just now, Adam McCarthy. We recorded an interview with him not so long ago. Terrific guy. I ended up going to a dinner at the Australian High Commission after that where I met the rest of his team, his wife as well. Lovely, lovely people.
Did you eat kangaroo?
No, we didn't. It was a very, very nice dinner. There was no kangaroo on the menu. But the Australian High Commission in South Africa doing some really interesting work too, and I thought it would be interesting for us to catch up with him. So if you want to know what that discussion was all about, you can listen to it next at 8 o'clock. Is Rich there now? Hello, Mulholland? Mulholland. Testing. Is he on the phone or on Skype?
He was on Skype, but we lost him.
Right, he was on Skype, now we've lost him. God, this is complicated. I think he's still in Brazil.
Bing,
bing, oh, bing, that was the sound of him coming.
I love that.
You like that, Ben?
It's very happy,
is that your favorite
isn't it?
Tune?
One of my favorites.
Rich.
Yo.
Good morning, man. It's hard to get hold of you this morning. Good Lord.
So we were doing a telephone tag back and forward. It was coming through my laptop. I was trying to use my phone.
No,
what a time to be alive.
So how is Brazil, first of all? Everybody's excited. Leanne wants to know if you got a Brazilian wax.
I did. Yeah, absolutely.
And
it's
you
beautiful.
Ate Brazilian nuts? In a
did you eat Brazil nuts?
I did. So I did have Brazilian nuts. One of the hosts of the place I was staying there is a guy called the Nutty Bavarian.
Yes.
And I had lots of nuts.
Oh, there you
so
go.
There we go. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, very exciting. Did you get to see any of the sites, the Copacabana? Did you go up to the Christ up on Corcovado? Did you see the famous bay?
Jesus hid from me. I went to see him, but he hid behind the clouds.
Oh.
I reached out, but he didn't want to know.
Well, it's probably all those.
So
probably,
it was there for like, it was like 4 gigs in 4 days. So it was pretty tight. Like one morning I woke up in Sao Paulo. I had breakfast there. I had lunch in Curitiba and had dinner in Porto Alegre.
Wow. That's a whistle stop tour. My God.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in Rio for less than 24 hours.
Nice country though. Nice people.
Oh, the people are amazing. I love how my favorite thing is how you shake hands there.
Mm.
Like they shake your hand and then they pat your shoulder. It's like they're saying, hey, man, there's a business side to this and there's a personal side too. Like, I want to do business with you, but I also want to relax a little bit and pat you on the back. And everybody you handshake with pats you somewhere. And like all over different places. It's pretty amazing.
Sounds so good. All right. So tell us some more. What have you got on your agenda today? There's usually something that you want to reality check us with.
Oh, dear. Okay. So I'd like to discuss a trend I'm seeing increasing on social media and in the world in general.
Uh-huh.
I call it haftivism. And it's when people half commit to a cause, and I really can't behind that. I can't get behind that. Like, I think they should shit or get off the pot.
Mm-hmm.
So two cases of this appeared in front of me yesterday. The first was on Twitter, and it was a tweet by an American journalist, and I just want to read this to you. She said, among the multiple journalists President Trump has insulted this week, three of them are black women. This is something – there is something so wrong with this, I had to speak up. I then proceeded to link to a clip in which she ripped him a new one for doing that. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the way he speaks to journalists when they ask him critical questions, which is their job, is often kind of puerile and deplorable. However, to state that you think it's doubly bad that he speaks to black women the same way he speaks to a white man is ridiculous to me. In my mind, would you prefer that he changes the way that he speaks to someone based on their gender and the color of their skin? Because this reporter referred to this act as racist and misogynist. And actually, though, in my mind, the opposite would be true here.
Mm.
Had he used racist or gender slurs in his put-down, that would have been different. However, in the clip, and I'm not sure if you saw it, he said, you ask stupid questions. I watch your work often, and you always ask stupid questions. Was it rude? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But racist and misogynist, not even a little bit.
Well, you see, he can't be accused of that because just a few days earlier, he was being accused of being very mean to Jim Acosta from CNN. They revoked his White House press pass. And it certainly didn't have anything to do with his whiteness or his maleness.
Right. And that's where the haftivism comes in. You see, you can't be half in on equality. You're either for it or against it. If you're for it, you'll have to believe that Trump addresses black women the same way he addresses white guys like Acosta. Right? Anything else would be condescending. You can't have it both ways there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first point. And then the second one was over on Facebook. A friend of mine posted about her frustration with people using palm oil based on the damage it does to the forests and the 25 orangutans that get killed every day.
Yes.
Now, this was possibly stemmed by that advert that went viral recently, the banned one by British supermarket Iceland,
mm-hmm.
Where a cute wee orangutan is in the boy's bedroom. I'm sure many of you have seen it. And he's there because all the humans are in his forest. And as such, Iceland, the supermarket, not the country, obviously, has said that they will not be promoting products that have palm oil, mm-hmm. you know, to save the 25 orangutans. Well, for goodness sake, that's all very well and good, but they have no problem at all selling beef. And there's no advert of 90,000 cows hiding in a wee boy's bedroom because we're killing them. Now, I eat meat, so I don't really get to take a moral high ground here, but I kind of feel like if we were going to weigh up the amount of damage we're doing to the environment and the amount of animals being put out, I'm thinking the livestock industry is a far bigger place to stand than, the palm oil industry. And it amazes me that how outraged people are getting about this whole palm oil thing, but they have no problem saying this while wearing a designer leather jacket. Now, that, right. To me, is haftivism. Again, shit to get off the pot. And in fact, while I'm at it, there's another one. The last one I want to bitch about it here is this haftivism when it comes to religion. Oh, I believe in God. You know, I'm this religion, but I just don't go to church or really pray. I have my own relationship with God, though, and you can't judge me. Actually, I can, because I read the rule book. And he's pretty clear in the holy books, spouted by most religions, is you have to worship the guy on a schedule. Okay, so the irony is that you think you're better off here than me because I'm, because you're still acknowledging the guy.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're defying his law, yep. Right? He's going to be more pissed off with you. Me, I just think he's a fairy tale designed to keep the masses in check. But you, you believe that he's real, but you just ignore him.
Well, worse, so, again, you're so arrogant you think you can rewrite his rules. I mean, that's
exactly.
Outrageous.
And he's your holy God. So I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying shit or get off the pot. And don't be a haftivist. If you commit to something, commit hard. And that's my point.
Thank you very much. There we are. How's that?
My pleasure.
Back with fire in your belly. All right, Rich. Thanks so
cool,
much.
Cool, guys.
Man. Cool.
Have a fantastic week.
There he is, Rich Mulholland. Reality check on a Monday. Big thank you to our guests for this morning. It's 8:05. We're going to have a replay of the interview that we did with the Australian High Commissioner in a moment or two. But first, it's time for the un-news, which I'm very glad Ben has survived through the course of the show this morning. He's really done very well.
So you're looking a little pale there.
Well done, Ben.
Yeah. I feel be better by Wednesday.
Well, we'll see. Otherwise, if he's not here on Wednesday, we know what happened. Funeral plan.
R.I.P.
Didi Mabuza is still in Russia on sick leave. This is such a bizarre story. There is nothing actually wrong with him from a health perspective. He's just sick and tired of the Russian nuclear deal not going through in South Africa. He has threatened to stay in Russia until it does, to which Cyril Ramaphosa has asked if he has plenty of warm clothing. Maluzi Gigaba is apparently on the verge of being fired by Cyril and will do anything to keep his job. Without the ANC, all he has is a bunch of fancy suits, and he knows he can't sell those as they've been tailored to be inch perfect for him and him alone. Sorry, sir, do you carry on the left or the right? And finally, the Proteas have concluded a satisfactory tour to Australia with a 2-1 win in the ODI series. Now the players have the Mzansi Super League to look forward to, but many are unsure who they're playing for. Faf du Plessis, for example, is very unsure as he thinks his team, the Paul Rocks, must be a joke. But as Ben has told you, that's my team, so not all bad. Okay, have a good day in the company of CliffCentral.com. We shall see you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.